Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Africa has long been the troubled continent. It's got trouble aplenty still. But as the world mourns and honors Nelson Mandela this week, there's a real African upside conversation out there as well. It's a big market, increasingly stable, increasingly wired, and right now, with a continent-wide economy growing faster than any other. This hour on Point After Mandela, a look at what Africa could be. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's possible? What's coming for Africa? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Brooklyn in New York is Sean Jacobs, professor of international affairs at the New School, creator of the popular blog Africa as a Country, wink, wink, worked as a political researcher for the Institute of Democracy in South Africa. Sean Jacobs, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you, Jonathan?
Tom is the name. Thank you very much for joining us.
My apologies.
No problem. And joining me from Ziguinchor, Senegal, is Vera Songwe, lead economist at the World Bank. She's the World Bank's country director for Senegal, Cape Verde, Gambia, Mauritania, and Guinea-Bissau. She's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Africa Growth Initiative. Forbes magazine named her as one of the 20 young power women in Africa 2013. Vera Songwe, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you, Tom, for having me.
And with us from Washington, Jonathan Berman, author of Success in Africa, CEO Insights from a Continent on the Rise, senior fellow at Columbia University, senior advisor for the consulting firm Dahlberg. He also wrote Seven Reasons Why Africa's Time is Now for the October issue of the Harvard Business Review. Jonathan Berman, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom, a pleasure.
We've heard trouble and woe from Africa for a long time. You've got the seven reasons that Africa's time is now. Lay them down for us real quick here, Jonathan, so we have a sense of where the upside might lie.
Sure. Well, actually, I can reduce it to three basic trends that drive that. Governance, education, and connectivity. Over the last 20 years, Africa has become much sharper and better on its governance. You know, there's still a long way to go, but you'll find higher quality governments in countries around the continent. Second is education. There's a class of a cadre of well-educated Africans, particularly younger Africans, that just didn't exist before. You know, at Liberation Congo had less than 50 college graduates.
Wow.
This is a country of tens of millions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that situation has changed significantly. And then finally, connectivity. Best known is the mobile story. Africa has gone from zero penetration of mobile phones at the beginning of the century to near full penetration at this time, pushing 80 to 90% at this time. And that's been a complete revolution in how people do business, work with their families, and understand what's happening in the world.
You take those three, and out of those, you look ahead, say that you've got a huge market opportunity here, increasingly stable, the world's largest workforce coming, more and more government spending going to education, mobile exploding, and you know, most of the world's uncultivated cropland. I don't know if we want that cultivated or not. Also, there's all kinds of resources there. We've heard about that for years. With all that, do you see Africa as a potential India-style economy in waiting, a subcontinent waiting to come up, a potential China rise in the offing, or something different for Africa in this century?
I see Africa as a potential Africa. You know, people often ask, are they going to follow the Indian model, the Chinese model, the U.S. model? I suspect none of these, because each of these has their flaws. I mean, most notably, Africa is coming of age, if you will, or coming into modernity at a time of the knowledge economy. And so I would expect that their modernization looks very different than an industrial or labor-led modernization that you saw in China, for example.
That's interesting. We'll look at what that might be. Vera Songwe, there you are in Senegal as the world's attention has been focused on South Africa. What do you think of this rosy scenario for Africa in the decades ahead? I mean, South Africa itself, Nelson Mandela's homeland, has had economic difficulty lately. You can always find the headlines of conflict or political turmoil, or worse right now in the Central African Republic, real large-scale killing sometimes going on there. What do you think of the upside scenario for Africa, Vera?
I think that the upside scenario continues to look up. I think some of the things that we can add to that list, I think, are clearly solid macro fundamentals. What we're having now coming into the 2000s, 2002, 2008, and as we know, I think one of the big surprises of the crisis was that Africa wasn't the continent that totally collapsed because of the crisis. Africa continued to grow. Mm-hmm. And as you very well said, we came out in 2013 as the fastest growing continent. That was because in the last 10 years, we have ensured that our macroeconomic situations are better, revenue is going up, deficits are falling. Of course, with the debt forgiveness initiatives, our debt to GDP is better. What has all that meant is the second reason why I think that there's still an upside for Africa is investments. Investments are coming into the continent, foreign direct investment. I think for the first time in this decade, we had foreign direct investment and private capital, more of it coming in onto the continent than we've had aid. So Africa is becoming a destination for high return capital. We know now that in the United States and in a lot of the developing countries, because of low interest rates, a lot of the developed countries, because of low interest rates, people are looking for high return on capital. Africa today is a construction site. We need roads, we need energy, we need water, and I think that many foreign investors see the potential. As the Mo Ibrahim Index that just recently came out shows, even though we still have countries at the bottom of the governance index, what we see is a general trend. 98% of the countries have moved up, improved in the governance index, so they've done better overall. And so I think when you put the combination of better macro, a sustained better macro, because we have now over 15 countries that have been growing on the continent. Because when we talk about growth, we don't just talk about the growth in 1 year or the growth in 2 years. We're talking countries that have had sustained growth for 7-10 years at above 5%. So this is not a blip. This is not a flicker of the light. It's actually something that now countries are beginning to understand that. I think that what everybody talks about is what is the downside. The downside is that we should not just remain on a celebratory mode. Mm-hmm. We're clearly going up, but we cannot contain, as you know, if you're in a race, if you slow down, then somebody behind you will take over. So what we need to do is continue. I think even though we have a lot more investment coming into energy, we only have two or three countries in Africa today that have more than 80% access of their populations to energy. A lot of the energy on the continent is still heavy fuel oil, which is quite expensive. I think that the continent, the advantage that we have on the continent is clearly now we have more and more gas, so we can do cheaper energy. We have more and more hydro. We can do better hydro. We can also do more and more natural solar energy. I think that now we understand how to bring down the cost, and we can do a lot more of that. We can connect the continent much better. With 1 billion people, I think there is a lot of demand just internally on the continent that we need to exploit. We always talk about South Africa, and I think we say that South Africa is slowing down. But I think one of the things that's happening in South Africa, which has not yet maybe been well publicized, is the fact that South Africa is finally trading with the rest of the continent. South African banks are coming up into the continent. South African infrastructure is coming into the continent. South African management companies are coming. And I think there is expertise. There is knowledge. The South-South transformation of knowledge that is also happening at a big scale with South Africa. And my sense is that if we can do a lot more of that on the energy side, including on the telecommunication side, as we just talked about before, then we will see a virtuous cycle of the rest of Africa pulling back South Africa up, because we have the South African even mineral industry, which is much better, much advanced than the rest of the continent. One of the things that's happening in CAR, as you mentioned, is just the weak institutions that do not know how to better manage the mining sector. South Africa is not yet a panacea of that, but they're clearly much better in this. We have Mozambique, of course, and we have Namibia. So within the continent, I think this is one of the positives as well, is that we have good examples of how if you do it well, it can actually work. And there is a lot more of that exchange happening with the younger generation, with the leadership on the continent. So I actually see a lot of an upside for the continent in the future.
Sean Jacobs, how do you look at this? Where do you see hope and where do you see trouble on this map? I mean, in the Central African Republic, we've got what? American transport planes flying Burundian soldiers in there, rushing them in to stop a potential genocide there. We've got, real problems in many other countries as well. On the other hand, all this talk of upside, what sits on either side of the balance for you, Sean?
I mean, I think to start off, I would say that, I can't disagree with your first guest's points. If I'm going to be against good governance, better education, and more connectivity would just, you know, as a principle, that would sound silly. But I think just to let me just start off by saying Africa has, I think it's important to recognize that Africa has 54 countries.
Yes.
That those 54 countries, and I know that our blog has this mocking name, there are various levels of development between and in between and between them, and that they, many of them have very unequal relationships with each other. So like a country like South Africa, for example, part of its economy attracts people from within the subcontinent, you know, within Southern Africa. You have it dominating the economies of those other African countries. So when we talk about, like, you know, how we have to make things right, we have to keep in mind these sort of regional blocks, South Africa, I suppose, Nigeria, Kenya, and so on. Thirdly, I think Africa is already part of the world. I mean, not just in terms of resource extraction. People forget that Angola, Nigeria, Cabo Verde, these places are very important in when it comes to energy, you know, oil extraction. And finally, I mean, the other issue is like within countries. So, for example, it's easy to say that South Africa is doing really well. But if you ask, if you strip away from sort of what South African elites might tell you, and you talk to ordinary South Africans who are 16 years later, after the end of apartheid, still living in a shack, their life is worse and things have become more unequal for them, especially black South Africans, then they may not have the same argument. But in, and then finally, I think if you take, say, the example of the Central African Republic, that's that sort of clear case of how it's difficult to say whether Africa is doing better or worse, because the Central African Republic is in a particular region, you know, where there is political instability, you know, the parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo, not the whole one, but parts of it. You know, Burundi, there's some political instability there and repression. So you...
Plenty. Hold the thought, Sean Jacobs. We have to take a short break right here, but we'll come right back to it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Africa after Mandela, sub-Saharan Africa, really, and its 21st century outlook. Children in a primary school classroom in Uganda singing with their teacher behind us right here. You can join the conversation this hour. How do you think about Africa now? Are you focused on the turmoil and trouble, or do you see the next big success story in the making in Africa? Could Africa's people and resources and energy finally come together in the next decades for the big rise? What's pushing this continent forward and what's holding it back? Vera Songway joins us, a lead economist at the World Bank, today with us from Ziguinchor, Senegal. Sean Jacobs is with us. His blog is Africa as a Country. Wink, wink, of course, it's not. Professor of International Affairs at the New School, South African, joins us from Brooklyn. And Jonathan Berman's with us from Washington, D.C., author of Success in Africa. He's with the Dahlberg Strategy and Consulting Firm. As everybody has been saying goodbye and Godspeed and rest in peace to Nelson Mandela, the world thinking also about Africa, beyond South Africa. Here was the country's current president, Jacob Zuma, speaking yesterday at Nelson Mandela's memorial.
Madiba was a courageous leader. Courageous leaders are able to abandon their narrow concerns for bigger and all-embracing dreams, even if those dreams come at a huge cost.
Of course, the South African leader had plenty of booze as he came to the podium in the stadium there. President Obama spoke as well. Among many glowing tributes to Nelson Mandela, he also had a reminder that not everybody is up to that standard by any means. Here's Obama.
There are too many people who happily embrace Madiba's legacy of racial reconciliation, but passionately resist even modest reforms that would challenge chronic poverty and growing inequality. There are too many leaders who claim solidarity with Madiba's struggle for freedom, but do not tolerate dissent from their own people.
President Obama, Barack Obama, in Soweto yesterday at the memorial service for Nelson Mandela. Jonathan Berman, let me put a concern to you here. One of our listeners says, you know, the global economy will shine its divine light on the millions of dirt poor in Africa and have them make sneakers and T-shirts and eye products for pennies a day Africa will go from chaos to near slavery. Africa is insurance against the current crop of low-wage workers getting feisty. Now, you said, I think I heard you say, Jonathan, that you don't expect Jonathan to go on that low-wage industrial China path to development. Really? And if not that, then what? How do you bring up those millions who indeed very often are living on a dollar and change a day?
So, you know, there's a risk of that. And I think that one of your guests pointed it out earlier, that if Africa doesn't pursue an inclusive growth pattern, there'll be social discontent that could topple the entire growth trajectory. And so I think that the President Obama was right in calling that out. At the same time, first of all, that's a problem that I think we find around the world. I mean, if you talk to the people who are heading into Davos next month, that is what they care about in every country of the world, is the growing inequality, the growing income gap between rich and poor. And Africa is no exception to it. The pathway out is education, as I mentioned before, but really that's part of a larger picture of improved productivity, making workers, making people more productive in all the aspects of their life. So that, you know, the mobile phone has gone has taken a big step forward that way. But another is improved infrastructure, most notably power and roads. Getting the lights on means people can work throughout the day and also educate themselves even in the evening and do homework, right? But it also means that companies can run without generators. You know, the hum of Lagos today is the hum of a generator set.
But Vera reminds us that she says there's only two or three countries in the whole continent, incredibly, where 80% of people have access to power supply.
That's right. So I think the inclusion of power is both setting up, you know, privatizing large production electricity, but also getting it out to the last mile with creative solutions that are off-grid.
Off-grid meaning solar, wind, alternative energy kind of solutions?
Yeah, solar and wind, also micro power. So you might use small hydropower dams to supply small towns and cities rather than the large electrical grid like we have here in the U.S. You need to think about the delivery of that kind of service in a more diffuse way in Africa than you do here in the U.S.
Vera Sangwe, in Senegal, we've seen this recent survey from the Pew Global Survey report that showed Africans as or more optimistic than anybody else in the world when it came to their economic future. You know, more optimistic than the Middle East, certainly more optimistic than big parts of the world, but very concerned about inequality, even now. And of course, with growth, that can grow. Why do Africans have such optimism about their future? And what makes them so attuned to inequality already?
I think, as the last speaker was saying, one of the things that we've seen in every country that has been able to grow quite fast in every continent, I mean, we see it in Vietnam now, one of the big issues that Vietnam is struggling with is how do you make sure that the inequality gap doesn't happen. And the reason I use Vietnam is that it was for a very long time one of those countries that was able to bring down poverty, continue to grow, and stay more or less quite equal. And so they didn't have a big gap. But as the growth spurt continued, you begin to find, inequality begins to grow. The same thing in China. We see it more and more. So this inclusive growth, as easy as it is to say, becomes quite difficult. And I think that's the problem that we're having in Africa right now. We have two issues that are coming together at the same time. One is a very, very young population, which basically means this is a population that is not yet an income-earning population. Secondly, that young population does not have access to high skills, high education. And so as the continent starts growing and you want to move from basically comparative advantage minerals into productive innovation using technology, as one of the speakers was saying, you need a skilled labor force. If you don't have that skilled labor force, then the very thin layer that you have clearly then has a much higher income than the lower end of that layer. So I think that's one of the things that we are beginning to see on the continent, is this very young population coming in, very thin level of skills, and hence I think a very strong focus now on technical education, on more scientific education, more mathematicians, going back to the base. And the continent's done a huge, huge amount to get kids into school, boys and girls. And so in many countries, most of them are going to meet the MDGs on education and access. The problem that the continent is facing is quality. Is that quality good enough? And so basically there's a lot of work that needs to be done to improve the quality, to make sure that access comes with quality so you can get those better jobs. Because as companies come on the continent, they need to find people that can actually produce high-quality goods that we are actually seeing. And this is one of the good things I would talk about AGOA quickly. One of the things that's going to happen is that countries that succeed and continue to export to the United States and more developed markets are rising in productivity, and there is definitely an advantage there where I think the continent is asking the U.S. and Europe to open its markets more so we can go into transformation and get into this market, as opposed to this growth, which has been for a very long time driven by minerals going into other developing countries like China and Latin America, which was just basically transformation of raw minerals and not having any huge boost in productivity. And as we know, the mining sector does not create that many jobs either.
Big oil and fossil fuel resources expected to come online in Africa in the coming decades. As new drilling techniques go into effect there, may make some big energy powers. Of course, the energy curse can be that stunts other growth, and there's the overall issue of climate change attached to that. Sean Jacobs in Brooklyn, in that same Pew report, it's interesting, this was a survey of Africans, which found a striking amount of optimism looking ahead at their economic future. But when they looked at their concerns, it was so interesting. I mean, they tend to worry about the same problems as many others around the country, around the world, international financial instability, global climate change, and in Africa, Islamic extremist groups topping the list of concerns that Africa expressed. What about climate change on this continent, Sean? Is it particularly vulnerable or more or less vulnerable than others when it comes to this century's path for potential development?
I mean, one of the debates that's at the heart of this discussion is the relationship between the state and the market. And I think your other two guests are probably better disposed to debate about that, but it is a question of, like, what's the role of the state to merely facilitate the environment for business to, you know, produce and create this Africa or within those African countries that we want. And I think that's the same issue with how we've dealt with the environment in Africa, is that, yes, and in some instances it was the state that did that, but just there's been soil erosion, there's been no regard, I suppose, among these elites, both internal and external elites, who are making money in Africa, who are extracting resources, about these long-term consequences. And this is why, for example, with somebody, when Jonathan, with his book, unfortunately haven't read it yet, but he will probably tell you there's been a number of these kind of books that come out every other year.
Right. Africa's Rise. Here comes Africa. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'd be interesting to know from somebody like him, how are his arguments different when it comes to that relationship between the state and the market, so that we can avoid these kind of things that you just mentioned around the environment, et cetera, and around the kind of pressure that then leads to these, for example, these tensions, where people's expectations, they express them through these extreme forms such as Islamic militants.
Let us pick it up, Jonathan. I mean, it's true. There have been waves of this Here Comes Africa kind of talk for decades now. Big Foreign Affairs article on Africa earlier this year, they conclude that believing in a more prosperous African future requires a healthy dose of optimism, but not a leap of faith. But they do say it can be hard to stay optimistic about Africa's future when you look at the political pathologies that stand in the way. The state, and often, too often, corruption or heavy hand within the state can be real problems. What gives you this optimism in this phase, Jonathan, that might make it different from last false dawns?
So first of all, I would question the assumption that there are false dawns. Those books have mostly come out during a period of 4-7% growth for Africa.
Yeah, okay.
So it's hard to say that actually has been false.
Yeah.
But if you ask me what's new and why I have confidence about the business-government relationship, which I think Sean points to quite, that's quite a lucid and on-point target comment. It's the conversations I have with CEOs throughout the continent. They speak to a changing dynamic with government, one in which, previously it was sort of zero sum, almost what you might have had in Russia, where it was basically stay out of the government's way or wind up in the government's jails, or be co-opted by the government, right, and just be, just supporting a patronage machine. That in different places at different paces is changing. to where you have a relationship where business has a more technical relationship with government. And I'll give you one example. In Nigeria, they're eager to move up the competitiveness index.
Yep.
The World Economic Forum publishes every year a competitiveness index. The government and business are aligned on their interest to do that, but government has no idea how to do that. So they bring in business for its technical knowledge about that. And you see that repeated in committees like that around Africa. You know, those kind of blue ribbon commissions that serve government kind of get a snicker here in the U.S. But what you find if you talk to CEOs in Africa is that those actually are a means to achieve change.
Let's go to Scott in Nashville, Tennessee. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I spent a year in the DR Congo in 2012 and 2013.
Okay.
And one of the things that I realized after going is that the general Western understanding of words that are thrown around, like corruption and poverty and inequality, they have a totally different meaning in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, at least in Congo where I was. And I was hoping that your speakers could talk a little bit, maybe just to put some cultural understanding, you know, for the general public who might not quite be able to make the jump from corruption here in the U.S. to maybe corruption in you know, Central Africa.
I mean, I've spent some time in Eastern Congo. I'm not sure what you mean when you say poverty has a totally different meaning there. Do you mean that it's simply worse, deeper, that the scale is...
Well, I think, I mean, like, lack of opportunities. Like, an example would be here in the States, like, anybody can read a newspaper. Anybody has access to, you know, most people have access to the Internet. You can always find a reporter. There's always a platform to learn more. But in Central Africa... you know, in Congo, there was one radio station that was put on by the UN. There was no newspapers. There was no periodicals. It's tough to travel. It's just tough to connect and really be able to step outside your own personal, you know, spot.
Yeah, Scott, let us pick it up. Vera, I hear you there in Senegal. What about that? Scott's looking in the Eastern Congo, at least where he was, at poverty so deep that you're kind of in a bubble, even cut off from information.
Well, I'm not sure exactly where in Eastern Congo he was. I mean, one of the things that we have on the continent now is maybe this flourishing of newspapers and maybe too many, so that people don't have enough information because everybody that can read is running a newspaper station, and maybe there is some regulation needed. Now, in Eastern Congo, what we also have is clearly one of the conflict zones on the continent, which is now getting better, thank God. Mm. And I think we have also the new governor of Katanga, Moise Katumbi, who is doing great things and wonderful things, trying to regroup the society, bring the society together. I think the general concept of poverty is $1.25 a day and purchasing power parity, which means how much you can afford in an equivalent. And one of the things that you see in many of these economies, of course, is that there's a lot of informality. So people don't have jobs in the country, and maybe this is what the caller was talking about, is there are no stable jobs. You know, most of the people, 78% of the people are in agriculture. Agriculture is a seasonal job, so most people maximum are fully employed for 3 months. And the question is, what do you do with them after that? And so I can see how somebody would be totally confused or confounded by that notion. But I think the basic notions of poverty, of corruption, are universal. There is not an African concept of it and then a Western concept of it. I think you can find acute poverty in Manila, as you can find it in Southeast Washington, as you can find it in the DRC. These people are all in extreme poverty. They live below what is an acceptable line for subsistence. Now, I think that what we need to manage and what the continent is trying to do better is to see how you can target these people better. And this brings into question the issue of data. Where can you find them? How can we make sure that these transfers are well done so that they get to the right people? In a place like DRC where institutions are broken down, and you started the conversation with, I think, the speech of Barat talking about some of our leaders that are not doing what Mandela wanted us to do. And I just wrote an article in the Brookings called The Mandela Rule. And the four of those Mandela rules, which I think is what is maybe holding the continent back.
Vera, hold that thought. The Mandela rules, we would definitely like to hear as we look at Africa, continent-wide, sub-Saharan in particular, after Mandela. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Africa after Mandela. A little huge open-air market sound there from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Well, there's the nice commerce side of Africa. But it's not all gentle commerce. The Central African Republic has been really in a rough state lately. CNN reporter Nima El-Bagir caught gunfire on Monday, reporting near the city of Bosangoa.
They're shooting again. Okay. The shooting started again, so everybody's having to run for shelter inside. Should we take the other one? The children are all squashed here, so there's no room for us. You can see how terrified people are.
They're from the Central African Republic and American transport planes just in the last day or two, bringing in African troops from Burundi, trying to get a handle on what's going on there. We're looking at Africa after Mandela in this hour, the 21st century outlook, the upside story, but with full awareness that this is not an easy challenge. Vera Songwe joins us. She's a lead economist at the World Bank with us today from Senegal. Jonathan Berman, author of Success in Africa, joins us from Washington. And Sean Jacobs, professor of international affairs at the New School, has the popular blog Africa is a Country. South African native joins us. Vera, you had Mandela rules for Africa to bear in mind with the passing of South Africa's great statesman. Like what?
Yeah, I have four of them. I think the first one, and this is about institutions and building strong institutions, referring to CAR and all the other parts of the continent that are in trouble. The first one is a pivot to multi-party elections. I think that's what Mandela did. We need to look at transitions. We need to make sure that we have an electoral system that works. The second one is coalitions. Right now in a lot of the countries on the continent, one of the reasons why we continue to have crisis is that you have winner takes it all. So there is no sharing, there is no inclusiveness, and the only way you can get in is by riot. And I think that if we manage to work that out, which is something that the South Africans have succeeded in doing, we will get better. The next one is credible institutions. We don't yet have, we're making progress, but we don't yet have credible electoral institutions, something that the South Africans have also succeeded in doing. And when I talk about credible electoral institutions, I also mean opposition. We don't have a credible opposition and we don't have credible electoral councils. When does the election happen? When does it finish? And you need public responsibility. We need people to go out and vote. We need people to be able to express their civic engagement well enough, and that is not happening, which South Africa did. And finally, I think the one that everybody talks about is the certainty of exit. We need to make sure that leaders on the continent can exit. I think when you have transitions, it's easier to manage conflict. If nobody knows when you're going to go, if there is no certainty about what is the process, I think one of the speakers was talking about the private sector. What we're beginning to see is in countries where you have private sector growing and blossoming, like in Ghana and in Kenya and in Nigeria, they have managed to have an electoral cycle that is predictable. People don't need to wait and stop investments for 2.5 years, waiting to see when the next election will be held. The economic cost of the uncertainty around exits and when elections are going to be held on the continent and the social and political costs are quite expensive. And I think at some point we need to stop and say that fragility on the continent is because these institutions are not strong enough. And in celebration of Mandela, we just need to look at what he did in South Africa. And with these four rules, I think we can begin to address that problem of institutions, representation, transitions.
We heard that promise from the huge stadium where he was celebrated yesterday here from retired Anglican bishop, Bishop Tutu. We will follow Mandela's example.
We promise God that we are going to follow the example of Nelson Mandela.
There's a promise, but Sean Jacobs, I mean, Nelson Mandela, yeah, he exited. It was a great example, freely elected president, and stood down. On the other hand, the African National Congress has been in power ever since. He brought democracy to South Africa, and we haven't seen a turnover there. What about South Africa itself as an example of well-functioning democracy? How's it doing, Sean?
Right, but just let me just, I want to answer that, but let me just quickly say something to your caller from who talked about going to the Congo.
Yes, please.
I think he's probably right that what he saw was something that's kind of amplified, but he should also accept that America, in America, there's something called pork, that politicians do some with the same relationship that they have to their local voters, and often this is why people vote for them, despite the fact that they may have good information, or you have a history in America also of, you know, Tammany Hall type type politics. But let me just I agree with Vera about some of her rules, But I think one should be careful to not, and I suppose the tension between, say, Zuma's speech to the local audience yesterday and then Tutu coming at the end and asking the crowd not to boo him shows up the tension and the incomplete nature of what's happening in South Africa. So, for example, on Vera's, I think it was 5 points, she's probably right about multi-party government, but then some people in South Africa might suggest that having coalition governments in South Africa in the initial period may have prevented the ANC from not emphasizing so much questions of racial reconciliation, which was probably going to be fine anyway, and dealing more with questions of economic justice. And then secondly, the other one might be the issue of credible opposition in South Africa. So right now, the ANC is very unpopular. The leader is being accused of, you know, corruption, and then being, you know, not listening to the needs of his voters or the mass of South Africans. But here's the thing. The largest opposition party in South Africa, while racial inequality in South Africa equals class inequality, they oppose things like affirmative action, or they oppose things like, you know, dealing with massive redistribution of wealth. So the South African story, I think, yes, it's a useful lesson for other parts of the African continent, but we should be careful not to place them on too high a pedestal, because they still, right now after Mandela's passing, because he was such a huge presence, despite the fact that he was not involved in politics for more than a decade, many of these issues that are incomplete in South Africa are going to be addressed. And in a way, it's going to be the same issues that people are talking about, say, in Ghana, or they're talking about in Senegal now that Diouf is gone.
Yeah, let's go to Emmanuel, calling from Akron, Ohio. Emmanuel, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well.
Well, I was. What I wanted to contribute was, I grew up in Cameroon, came here, went to school here, and some of the stuff, especially what the government in Cameroon is doing, is some of us here that have like Western education and are naturalized citizens in America, and you try to say, okay, let me see what I can do to go back to help the government or to work with the government to see some of the stuff that is going on, maybe improve on the educational level and also the expertise level. But with the policies that they have brought into the country, that the government, especially Paul Biya, has implemented, it prevents us from doing that, because you cannot have like a dual citizenship to go back there like what Nigeria, if you feel like Nigeria is now improving, their economy is improving so much because of all the Western educations that they have in there.
So you don't feel welcomed home as part of, in your case, a Cameroonian diaspora. Let me ask about that, Emmanuel. I appreciate your call. Vera, what about it? Do you see African countries ready to welcome home Africans who may have gone abroad, become educated, and now interested in going back to maybe be part of this century's development? Is there a welcome mat for them or resistance?
I think there's clearly a role for the diaspora, and as you can see, the caller spoke about Nigeria. Nigeria is thinking now of launching a diaspora bond. Countries like Cape Verde have grown quite fast based on remittances. Tanzania, Kenya also have had substantial amounts of remittances. Senegal is one of them. I think two things that one has to remember: when there is a private sector that is also growing on the continent, and there is now what we're trying to get is a quality of treatment from the private sector, the local private sector and the foreign private sector. So once you get the diaspora coming back, either you have them coming back in an institutionalized fashion and engaging with the state, and the state then has to put down rules of engagement and how one does that. And I think it's also a question of reciprocity. The United States does not necessarily take its citizens' remittances and sort of recast it back into development. Nigeria is doing that and it's helping, and Cape Verde is doing that and it's helping. I go back to the question of institutions. It's not individually I need to go back and I need the citizenship. It's a question of what does the state want? But how does the institution, and I think Jonathan or Sean was the one talking about it, how do these institutions on the continent now prepare themselves and organize themselves to deal with the private sector, to deal with foundations that are coming onto the continent? And I think this is the next wave where we need to solidify those institutions and make sure that they can respond to a new set of demands and offers that are coming onto the continent.
Let me ask about another influence from outside. There's been a lot of talk around the world and in the United States about China's much grown footprint in Africa. Here's a little tape from May of this year at a meeting of African leaders, again in Ethiopia, the Prime Minister there and African Union chairman called China a reliable partner for Africa.
Some of our friends and partners have given priority to infrastructure development in Africa in terms of their strategic partnership with our continent. In this regard, I wish to take this opportunity to express my deepest appreciation to China for investing billions of this sector to assist us in our development endeavors.
Jonathan Berman, what about China's role in Africa's development? How big, how important, and what does it mean for Africa's political development? We understand China's politics. They're hardly Mandela style.
Yeah, so China's engagement in Africa is credible and significant. You know, one of the CEOs that was interviewed in the book commented, he's one of the largest private equity investors in Africa, and he said the most important thing about China for Africa is that China is not Europe. It is an alternative to traditional partners. But more than just being an alternative, it's a strong alternative. You know, we tend to create sort of a boogeyman of China in Africa, saying, oh, they're there only on the back of corruption. Well, leaving aside whether there is corruption or not, that is not why China competes and wins in Africa. They compete and win on Africa because of a combination of price, quality, delivery, and timing. The same as anybody competes anywhere in the world, and especially on timing. China and its state-owned enterprises and even its large private enterprises are prepared to invest over a period of decades. That's extraordinarily hard for a Western company operating in public markets, which has to answer on quarterly returns.
So I still wonder, Sean, let me bring it to you, of the impact of this. That's investment coming in. That's new roads and bridges. Jonathan says they compete on, you know, price and quality and timing, but we've also heard plenty about corruption that may accompany that. I don't mean to say it's only China, but it's certainly pointed to there. And no demands made, no about the political system or human rights or anything else. What about China's net impact on the continent, Sean?
I mean, it is true, and I think Jonathan probably put it best. It's credible and significant investment. And you're right, they built very large stadiums and, you know, highways, but it comes at a price. I mean, China, of course, also wants to extract resources from the African continent, you know, like raw materials. And I think China's also sort of eyeing up the energy resources of Africa. And for that, you can't blame them. I think the debate about China, and I think that's what Jonathan also talked about, is like how the reaction against China in the West is almost like, you know, what right has China got to do this? Well, China is just like any other power right now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the West is not doing that well economically. It goes through all kinds of booms and busts and recessions, and China has money. So if you, and unfortunately, if you're an undemocratic or an unresponsive state to your citizens, it seems China is easier to deal with and not asking you uncomfortable questions. So I think the thing up ahead, and this is why I said in the beginning, it's a question of, you know, when we talk about the relationship between the state and the market, if we're going to rely purely on private institutions to make this new Africa that we want, I think then we're going to fail when, say, we're confronted by, say, a power like China, which is undemocratic at home.
Yeah.
Is that you need to strengthen and you need to emphasize the importance of the state within society, not just to facilitate the space for markets to function and flourish. And this is why I think it's important not to only get stuck on, and this is not a criticism, and talking about, say, you know, we need good elections and we need lots of parties, because you can have good elections and lots of parties and it doesn't lead to any kind of real change. It means also we have to accept that, you know, the relevance of social movements, because, for example, China would not get away with the kind of wages they're paying people in Zambia or they're paying people in Congo if there were strong trade unions, for example.
Some kind of civil society development there. We're talking about Africa after Mandela. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Let me try and get one more call, if I may. David in Buffalo, New York. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, major parts of Africa and South America have natural habitat, and they have rainforests, and I think we all agree required for the health of the world. So how are we going to maintain a balance between the need for that and development of the economies?
It's a great question. Vera Songwe in Senegal, is there a kind of ratio here? Does development mean destruction of Africa's natural environment?
The answer, I think, is no. I think what we're beginning to see, and this is where technology and innovation comes in, is how can we use our natural environment better? I think now we know how to use solar energy at a cheaper price. We know how we can capture and do better hydro. And we know, and so I think what the question is, and maybe where you get a reaction on the continent, is normally the question of climate change is being posed as an either-or. But many of the countries on the continent are suffering from flooding. They are suffering from changing weather patterns. And so countries are actually beginning to think about it seriously. They don't think about it as, you know, is it a climate change issue and do I have to respond to it? They're thinking about it as resilience. How can we make our countries more resilient? How can we build better cities? How can we have better urban planning? How can we make sure that we have better transportation systems that, you know, so, and how can we use our water better? And this is happening much more. We're having better regional integration, better stories around using waterways to make sure that it's equally shared and well used. So my sense is the continent is posing the question in a different way because they cannot afford, and this is clear, to do both and say we're going, and one of the things that we're asking, and I think as multilateral institutions like the World Bank are doing, is seeing how one can cost and price carbon, because carbon on the continent could actually help foster development even faster. And so that dialogue on climate change and what one does has to be a multi-way dialogue where you say, you know, we're also willing to pay for the continent that has the biggest forest and basically is contributing to a cleaner environment overall. And we have not managed in a multilateral context to have these discussions in a way that is beneficial to the continent. And this is, I think, one of the things we need to continue to push on and make sure that it happens.
David in Buffalo, I'm glad you raise it. I mean, if it were China-style development there, that would be terrible for that environment. But maybe it's something else entirely. We will watch with rapt attention. Vera Songway, Jonathan Berman, Sean Jacobs, our great thanks to all three of you for joining us this hour to look at Africa after Mandela. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.